Today on the 21st, how much has the federal government changed the way it enforces immigration law under President Donald Trump? Lawyer Ruth Wyman was with a client in Urbana for a first-time alleged DUI. Federal immigration authorities arrested him at a mall shortly after a court hearing.
Three white men in plain clothes approached him and asked him if he was, and then said his name. He said yes. And they showed a badge and said, "We're from ICE," and said, "We're here to arrest you."
We'll talk with Ruth about what happened next. Chicago immigration attorney Moises Hernandez also joins us to share what he's been hearing from his clients in Chicago. Then we'll hear about the mood among immigration activists from U of I student Jaime Nolasco and talk with WBEZ Chicago reporter Odette Youssef, who's been reporting on a special kind of visa, the U visa. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, we talked about what immigrating to Illinois has looked like for the past few months. Today, we wanted to talk about what has changed for people who are already here. During last year's presidential campaign, President Donald Trump said he would deport all people who came to the U.S. illegally. And even though he said he would only target people with serious criminal records, and last week added students who are dreamers should, quote, rest easy. What does all of this mean? And have things changed with ICE? That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement since President Trump took office. We know that President Obama did deport more people than any other previous American president. 2.4 million formal deportations during his time in office. Speaking of President Obama, he's actually in Illinois, by the way. We're going to be talking about that later in the hour. But first, we're discussing immigration. As always, you are welcome to join us with your questions or comments. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your comments to 21STShow. That's our handle, 21st Show. We're joined now in studio by Ruth Wyman. She's an attorney in downtown Urbana with her own law practice. Ruth, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for inviting me.
2 weeks ago, Ruth, you were with a client at the courthouse for what would have been a fairly routine pretrial hearing for first-time charges of a DUI. What happened after that?
Well, we had gone, as we had gone just about every month for the pretrials, criminal pretrials for whether it's a misdemeanor or felony alleged offense. You go to let the judge know we're still negotiating, we need discovery, we're waiting on this, we're waiting on that. And it was a pretty routine thing. Actually, I had just negotiated with the assistant state's attorney what I had hoped for and perhaps still hope for is what's called a court supervision plea, which is for a misdemeanor where it's a suspended sentence. So there's not actually any guilt. It's not conditional discharge or probation or jail time, as long as over the 6 months or 12 months, you don't end up having any other criminal problem. So we had talked about that, but advised the court that we wanted to continue it one more time and so set it out. I was talking with the client and I said, you know what, let's go over, let's talk about the next things, next process we should do. And I said, you know, I don't have anything else going on this afternoon. Let me walk with you. So we were walking, went into the Lincoln Square Mall, sat down talking. I was explaining things to him. And then three middle-aged white men came up to us and asked the gentleman I was with if he was, in fact, who he was. And they used his name, and he said yes. And they pulled out their badges and said, "We're from ICE," or maybe they used the more formal term, and said, "You're under arrest." And I said, how can he be under arrest? He hasn't done anything wrong. Oh, well, he came into the country illegally. And I said, how did you find out about this? I was stunned. I was outraged. And they said, oh, it's on the internet. We can find this. And in fact, all court hearings are on the internet, on the circuit clerk's website. So if someone were following and wanted to look up and find out when is this person's next hearing, they could find it by looking up under his name or under his case number. What was really disconcerting or alarming to me was that my concern and what I've heard with others from others who are active in immigration issues is that the probation department in Champaign County and apparently also in McLean County, it turns over information. Even if you have just a court supervision, get take court supervision, which again is a suspended sentence, not conditional discharge or probation. We'll turn it over to ICE. And my assumption is that from a prior case, probation had done that, and that's how my client got on ICE's radar.
So you were his attorney for these DUI charges.
Yes.
Have you spoken with his immigration attorney? What's happened?
Well, he's still being held. I've spoken with his girlfriend, who is a who's U.S. citizen. My client has a 1 and 2 year old, 1 and 2 year old children who are U.S. born, and so we've been communicating to see if there's any way that we can help. And I've provided to her and to her attorney, to the immigration attorney, all the documents. There'll be a bond hearing to see if he can at least get out on bond, awaiting these immigration issues.
So he's currently being held in Missouri right now.
That's correct.
That's Ruth Wyman. She's an attorney in downtown Urbana. I want to bring a couple other folks into this conversation. Both of us, both on the line from Chicago, an immigration attorney, Moises Hernandez with Hernandez and Reynolds Law Firm. Moises, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me on.
In a few minutes, we're also going to be speaking with Odette Youssef. She's a WBEZ Chicago reporter who's going to be joining us to talk about all of these issues as well. Moises, you just heard Ruth's story. You're an immigration attorney. Is what she described, is that a standard story? Have you heard this kind of story before happening?
I wouldn't say it's standard, meaning that that's the routine practice everywhere. But yes, we have heard those stories. It does happen, and it highlights kind of one of the issues that gets lost in a lot of the conversation about, yes, deport anyone who's here illegally, they're criminals, blah, 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 which, by the way, of course, they are not. Immigration violations are civil violations. They are not charges. That's something that's in the rhetoric and even in the coverage in the media often just inaccurately reported. These are criminals. Actually, it is not a criminal violation. If you've overstayed your visa here, it is a violation of immigration law, certainly, but it is not a civil violation
is what you're saying, not a criminal one.
Yeah. However, my point was that a lot of the fallout, a lot of the consequences from the aggressive immigration rhetoric, you know, coming right out of the executive, is that there's a lot of fear in the community, and then there are all these consequences, right? Children who are very scared that their parents will be deported and their families will be separated. Many law enforcement agencies have spoken out about the fact that they need people in communities to trust the police, that the law enforcement depends on community cooperation and trust in the law enforcement agencies. And if the courts are seen or police are seen as people who are likely to, call immigration authorities on you, based on a suspicion, and let's remember that, based on a suspicion of what your status may or may not be, because, of course, the police generally don't really know what anybody's immigration status mm-hmm. is.
What about, Moises, can I ask about your clients right now, to Ruth's point about she's not an immigration attorney. She was representing this client in another proceeding, but then that's how ICE was alerted to that. Are you finding from your clients a difference in the amount of ICE raids or pickups of people? What are you seeing in Chicago?
First, generally a culture of, great apprehension in the immigration community, but we are seeing, aggressive enforcement action, which also, as you mentioned in your intro, and thank you for doing that, it has already been the case. What there is a lot of fear in the community, and there we have seen for years where people do end up in deportation in proceedings or in ICE custody after they attended, if not necessarily a court date. What we've been seeing a lot is people who were attending their probation or parole, and so they're reporting regularly, taking an example like Ruth's case, a little further down the line, they got a plea agreement, they're complying with everything. So these are people who are trying to follow the law, right? And they're going to their probation, and they have 12 months of check-in. And at one of those check-in dates, when they walk out of the office or even in the office when they're meeting, when they're going in there to wait to meet with their probation officer, an ICE officer is there waiting for them. Now, agencies may say that they do or don't cooperate with the authorities, but clearly that's been a pattern we've seen for years where people going into probation offices are being detained, and clearly there is some coordination there because they know what date they're there, they know what officer they're there to meet.
And so, and that hasn't, to your mind, has that changed then under the Trump administration from the Obama administration, or is it?
We have already been seeing that. I think my this is not the statistical. My impression is that it depends on the jurisdiction and what kind of relationship they have with ICE and who is. And of course, it gets very murky. They don't necessarily tell you who's sharing information, but obviously, you begin to see a pattern. You understand this is not a coincidence. This isn't a one-off. This is people are regularly, you know, coming in to retain attorneys for their immigration case who got into immigration custody exactly that way. Yes, he went to check in. He's been going for 12 months, and on the last of his monthly check-ins, immigration was there to detain him. So that has already been happening for a while.
Okay. That's Moises Hernandez. We're speaking with two attorneys, Moises Hernandez and Ruth Wyman, both of them, about ICE enforcement. Moises mentioned the different jurisdictions, and our producers at the 21st reached out to five different county sheriff's office last week to tell them we were having this conversation. We reached out to Peoria, Champaign, Sangamon County in Springfield, the McLean County Sheriff's Office in Bloomington. Here's what they told us. Sheriff McCoy in Peoria declined our request for a comment. We did not hear back from either McLean, Sheriff Sandage in McLean County, or Sheriff Barr in Sangamon. Sheriff Dan Walsh in Champaign did respond to us, in fact. He told us he's tired of repeated media requests about the issue, and he referred us to a statement he released back in March, which reads in part that Champaign County has never passed any laws claiming sanctuary status. This kind of gets into this murky area of what is a sanctuary city, what isn't. It explains what they understand to be the current law regarding detainer requests. It says that they believe in a recent decision from Illinois federal court found that ICE does not have the legal authority to issue detainers. It does say in Champaign County, for example, the sheriff's office does take fingerprints of persons who are booked into jail. ICE has access to that, as well as notifying the timing of release so they can take action when it deems appropriate. They said the Champaign County Sheriff's Office orders all court orders and judicially entered warrants. And again, Sheriff Dan Wolf said, I'm not making any political statement in these matters. I'm simply trying to follow the now current law, and adds that they're continuing to monitor both the current law and new court decisions regarding all of these matters. It's kind of confusing. I want to bring someone else in to help us understand all of this. Odette Youssef is a reporter with WBEZ in Chicago Public Media. She's there live from their Northside Bureau. Hey, Odette, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having me.
Odette, what's a detainer request? What does that mean?
So detainer requests are requests that come from ICE and are sent to local law enforcement agencies that say basically, you know, hey, we know that you have this person in detention right now, perhaps on some sort of local, criminal charge that they were convicted of, spending jail time for that. We know you have that person there. We're just going to ask you to hold on to them for a little bit longer after they've finished serving out their time so that we can get our ICE agents over to where you are and so they can detain that person and start processing that person on immigration charges. So this is something that is really a request. It is not something that local law enforcement agencies by law have to honor. And it's something that, as you mentioned, in Champaign County and the city of Chicago and Cook County, if we're looking at Illinois, they've determined that honoring those detainer requests would violate those individuals' Fourth Amendment rights.
Right. So that's constitutional. They consider it a constitutional violation. So they're not honoring that. They did say, though, that the sheriff's office takes fingerprints, that's shared with ICE, that kind of they also schedules the people who are being released. How does that, and we've heard Moises and Ruth talk about just information for probation hearings and things like that. Does the same thing happen in Cook County or through the court systems, or is it basically pretty standard that this information is shared with Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
Yes, my understanding is that the local law enforcement agencies here in Chicago and Cook County, they, you know, when they fingerprint somebody who's been charged, that information does get run up through the same sort of federal database that the Champaign County Sheriff is referring to. The question really is, are they going to notify ICE that of when somebody is going to be released? And that's something that is not allowed according to the welcoming ordinances here in Cook and Chicago. And it seems from the statement from the Champaign County Sheriff that that's something that they don't do either.
Right. And I guess this is really one of these murky areas where every different county, I guess, would it be, Odette, up to every different sheriff's office to sort of determine? They have to kind of work, as they said, as Sheriff Dan Walsh said, they have to work with their state's attorney to kind of figure out how they're going to do this enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, I think every sheriff can make that determination of whether they believe that they should be complying with these detainer requests. And they are, you know, they are going to their state's attorneys because there is case law that has found that these detentions are not legal. And there are other liability concerns as well. And I should mention, Nyla, that, you know, when the federal government is asking these places to hold on to somebody, they're not giving them any money to do that. So it's entirely at the expense of the local law enforcement agency if they end up detaining someone for any additional time.
That's WBEZ's Odette Youssef. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. We've been speaking with Ruth Wyman. She's an attorney in downtown Urbana with her own law practice. She started this conversation by sharing her story. Ruth, thanks for that. I appreciate it. We've also been speaking with Moises Hernandez with Hernandez and Reynolds Law Firm in Chicago. He's an immigration attorney, about what he's seeing with his clients. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Odette. She's been doing some reporting in particular about law enforcement and victims of violent crimes. And we're going to be talking to some students, a student activist at the University of Illinois. As always, you're welcome to join our conversation. Tweet to 21STShow. You are listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about immigration and customs enforcement, ICE enforcement, under the Trump administration. We've been speaking with two attorneys, Ruth Wyman in Urbana and Moises Hernandez, an immigration attorney in Chicago. Ruth, I wanted to ask you, given what we were just talking about with hearing about how different clients and what happened, the story you shared of your client who was detained after showing up for court for something, for a different charge, being detained by ICE authorities, has that changed the advice that you're giving clients who are coming to you, who maybe are either have overstayed their visas, never had documentation, whatever their status is?
It really has. And before, when clients, whether it was a criminal defense, mostly in family law, which is the other area that I practice, it'd say, is it okay for me to go to the courthouse? Am I, you know, we've got this hearing, or should I just let you go? And I'd say, oh, don't worry about it. You know, we can walk over together if you want, but not a problem. Anymore, I'm not sure I would tell a client to come unless it's absolutely necessary for them to come. And in a lot of cases, custody cases, visitation cases, you need the client to come. But I'm certainly much more apprehensive about telling the client to come, to, you know, putting it as a hearing or to setting it up weeks in advance, because then it goes up on the Internet. And I would rather try and set something up at the last minute, try and arrange it with the court just to get that in without setting off or letting ICE agents who are lurking around find that information. Because what's happening is that these families are being ripped apart simply because of their immigration status. And I think that fear, which before I would have said, don't worry about it, I think you're overreacting, I don't think it's an overreaction anymore.
Moises, do you agree? Oh, I'm sorry. It looks like we've lost Moises for that. Ruth, can I just ask you, what kind of impact do you think this has on the overall legal system? If this is, I imagine, sure, you're one attorney in Urbana. When we think about the legal system, not just across Illinois, but across the country, what kind of impact do you think this will have?
I think it's going to have a huge impact, and for the worse. I had talked with, and whenever I represent someone who is not a U.S. citizen. I'll talk with an immigration attorney that I know from law school up in Chicago. And I say, well, if he takes this plea or that plea, if this is what we negotiate, is this going to be all right? Is that going to affect immigration? And I've done that in prior cases. And they say either, you know, it's got to be this or it's got to be that. It can't be a felony. It can't be, you know, those sorts of things. Certain drug offenses can't be cocaine, can't be heroin, but pot was okay. Things like that. That I don't think is any longer okay because of what probation or the courts or the sheriff's office are doing across Illinois. And so anymore, instead of taking a plea, I'm going to have to tell each client, we're going to trial because we can't simply take the risk of what the probation department is going to turn over. And so you have an already clogged legal system with jury trials and that sort of thing. It's going to be even worse.
That's Ruth Wyman, an attorney in Urbana. On the line with us as well has been Odette Youssef from WBEZ, Chicago's North Side Bureau. Odette, you were reporting, you know, we've been talking about law enforcement, and you were reporting recently, we'll tweet out the link to that story that you did last Thursday about law enforcement and one particular issue about people who are here, whether they're undocumented or whatever their legal status is, and they've been victims of violent crime. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So, you know, one of the interesting things I think about the change in the political rhetoric around immigration has been, you know, President Trump has really highlighted the possibility that large numbers of immigrants may be committing crimes. And we know, for example, that he has authorized the creation of an office at DHS to liaise with victims of violent crimes that have been committed by undocumented immigrants. So that's been sort of the backdrop here lately. What's happening here in Illinois is that if you're the victim of a violent crime or a witness to a violent crime and you're undocumented, if you provide significant help to local law enforcement in reporting that crime, investigating that crime, or the prosecution of that crime, that should make you eligible for something called a U visa. And U visas are basically temporary visas that would authorize someone's residence in the U.S. for up to 4 years. And often what people do is if they get a U visa, well, within 3 years, they can apply for a green card. So that's usually what happens. The problem is, in order to even apply for a U visa, the local law enforcement agency that you assisted with the crime has to certify that you helped them. And so what we're finding in Illinois, according to some organizations, and we also FOIA'd information from six of the Chicago area counties on this, is that the rate at which different local law enforcement agencies are providing that certification to the victims or witnesses of these violent crimes really varies. And so it depends on where you are. In Cook County, the state's attorney's office, for example, in 2015, certified more than three quarters of the requests for the U visas that it got. But in some of the other counties here, it was as low as 20%. And so, you know, this has raised concerns with domestic violence counselors, for example, and some immigration attorneys who say it shouldn't matter. You know, if you help some law enforcement agency put someone who's dangerous behind bars, you know, it shouldn't matter where you live, you know, if when it comes to whether that will qualify you for this U visa. And so that's an issue that they're highlighting. And there is now an effort underway in the Illinois General Assembly to address this legislatively.
And how would they address that, Odette?
So this would be part of something called the Illinois Trust Act. It's not the entirety of the act, but the portion of it that addresses U visas would establish sort of statewide standards. It would require law enforcement agencies to respond to these requests for U visa certification within 90 days. And it would require them also to have a designated officer who handles these requests. And it would also ask them it would require them to establish their own written policies on how to handle U visa requests so that everybody in a police department, say, would be clear on what are the criteria they need to consider if they're handling one of these certification requests.
And so, Det Yusuf, WBEZ in Chicago, joining us to talk about, you know, we've been talking about how actions from ICE, it's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, what that activity looks like, how different it is from what's happened during the Obama administration. Det, any sense that activity is different than we heard Moises say he doesn't, it doesn't necessarily seem like things have changed in terms of the number of raids or enforcement. We mentioned, of course, President Obama having deported a record 2.4 million formal deportations during his presidential term. Do you have any sense that in the past several months, anything has changed in terms of the numbers of deportations?
You know, that's been so tricky for a number of reasons. One of them being just the lag. You know, we've put in freedom of information requests to Immigration and Customs Enforcement on those numbers and still haven't gotten anything back. These are requests that went out more than 2 months ago. And so there's always a lag. You know, from what we're hearing, I believe last week, Syracuse University tracks some of these numbers. And what they found is that when it comes to immigration court cases, there actually has not been much of a change under Trump as opposed to under Obama. I do think that, you know, what we can say is that if the we don't know that the numbers have changed, but we do know that the priorities appear to have changed.
As we're talking about that, we wanted to turn the conversation to another group of immigrants who have received so much attention here in Illinois, and that's students. Dreamers are the terms given to groups of young people who've spent most of their life here in the U.S., even if they don't have the legal authorization to be here. In terms of that priority shift Odette just mentioned, President Obama protected this group from deportation when he signed executive action on deferring their deportation. Officially, it's known as DACA. If you've heard that term, deferred action for childhood arrivals. President Trump said last week he's not targeting DACA students or young people in his immigration enforcement, that they should, quote, rest easy. Joining me now in studio is a University of Illinois student who's joined us to talk about this issue in the past. Jaime Nolasco is a senior in the history department at the University of Illinois. His mother brought him to the U.S. from Mexico when he was 2. Hi, Jaime. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, when you were just 2 months old. Sorry, not 2 years old, 2 months old.
Yes.
So President Trump said last week in an interview with the Associated Press that dreamers should, quote, rest easy, and that, quote, he is not after the dreamers. We are after the criminals. And he added, quote, that is our policy. How does that make you feel?
So just to clarify, you know, there's definitely been pushback on the word dreamers because there hasn't been any legislation.
The DREAM Act has actually introduced by Senator Dick Durbin, never been passed.
It has never been passed. So it's there's definitely been pushback on that word. Most are associated with documented, undocumented students. But aside of that, like on the tension, there's much tension on campus. There's students who are pretty much out there in the open saying that they're going to call ICE on undocumented students.
You've heard students at the University of Illinois say that?
Yes, about two to three weeks ago, some Republican student pretty much said that he was going to call ICE on me specifically because, you know, I was calling them out on the whole chalkings and whatnot. So the tension on campus is pretty much undocumented students don't feel safe. There was, like, I guess 5 to 6 ICE trucks about 2 weeks ago, and we were just wondering, should we go out? Should we not go out? Should we order food? Who do we open the door for? It's definitely a real danger for us as well.
And sorry, you mentioned chalkings. Was this an incident that happened on the
campus?
Yes,
about two to three months ago, I think. I think a month or 2 months ago. I can't remember the exact timeline, but there was chalkings where it was like stop supporting, start deporting, pretty much xenophobic comments, anti-immigrant rhetoric aimed at undocumented students, basically, which is...
Right. Now, and I know we've heard from different schools about how they're handling this issue. The University of Illinois has said it will do everything it can within the law to protect all of its students, including those who are undocumented. Do you feel like, what's your sense of how things are right now? How do you feel?
So I've been working with a group of undocumented students and with the administration closely on how we could best protect students, right? We host ally trainings. We work with the administration all the way from the chancellor all the way to cultural house directors. And I think it's Pretty much, it's a sanctuary campus without the word.
Right, there's not that technical term, right? Right, because the university has said that they don't want to use that term in particular. Now, you didn't ever apply for DACA status.
Yes. So the November elections were a shock to me. I was gonna apply for DACA in January, and graduate this May and have a job. But with the new administration, I was pretty much afraid to apply for DACA. What if I'm denied for some small technical reason, and then ICE is showing up on my door? So I'm still considering whether I should apply for DACA or not. And those comments, if I should rest easy, are still, I think I shouldn't trust them at this point. But we'll see where I go from there.
Odette, can I ask you about this whole notion of sanctuary city, sanctuary campuses? Chicago says that they're a sanctuary city. Well, how does that work, for example, with schools? Like, for example, with Chicago Public Schools or with churches? What happens if ICE agents show up at those doors?
So according to a 2011 memo that was issued by the Department of Homeland Security, ICE is supposed to avoid conducting raids in so-called sensitive locations. And included in those sensitive locations are hospitals, schools, and places of worship. And so, we've heard of cases, and I've covered a case here in the suburbs of Chicago in 2015, for example, where, ICE might get close to one of those locations, but as far as I know, we don't know of any cases where ICE has actually entered onto the premises of one.
For students who are in your situation, and I'm thinking about what Odette's saying, but also just the very real fear, obviously, that you're living with, I think a lot of people who are listening may be wondering why you speak publicly about this. You've been really open about this. You've gone to Springfield. You've been an activist about this for a long time.
I've advocated for undocumented students for about 2 years now, both at on the local level and the state level, and I think it's very important that we continue advocating for undocumented students for access to higher education. I believe it's 1 to 3% of undocumented youth actually graduate from a 4-year institution. So it's definitely hard for students, undocumented people, to go to college. So I definitely want to continue advocating and sharing my story, right? Sharing stories.
And you don't feel worried that, like, maybe I shouldn't be talking about this?
Of course. We just recently held our second annual Coming Out of the Shadows on campus, in which undocumented students share this story to pretty much everyone on campus. And it's an important thing that we have to do, I think, as undocumented students. But there's also that that fear behind what happens if if I'm reported to ICE, and I may be jaywalking, or my girlfriend takes me to the mall or something, and then ICE is there, right? There's that fear of what if, right? For undocumented students, and in my own personal experience, I think I have to prepare just for simple trips, right? For the mall, I have to know what I'm gonna do, what I'm gonna carry, what I'm gonna say if ICE agents show up, what I'm supposed to do, what I am supposed to do. So there's definitely that fear, yes.
And what are you thinking now? What are you're graduating in May?
Yes, I'm graduating in about 12, 13 days. I may apply for DACA. I'm just hearing news as it comes out, but I'm definitely gonna be applying for law school. I'm gonna start applying, start practicing for the LSAT for sure.
Yes. That's Jaime Nolasco, who is a graduating senior with the University of Illinois, sharing his story with us as he has in the past. Jaime, thanks for being here. I appreciate
it.
I want to thank Odette Youssef as well with WBEZ, joining us from their Northside Bureau in Chicago. Odette, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We are going to be actually talking about President Obama. He's in Chicago. He's talking now. That's coming up next. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. Every Monday, we bring you the latest in Illinois politics. And today, what a day. President Obama is making his first public address since leaving office. And since, like, his last public speech before he left office, it's in Chicago. There's lots going on in Springfield, a women's march, lots of conversation about the House voting on a bill related to abortion that's become quite controversial. Joining us to talk about all of this from Chicago is senior political reporter and author of the Illinois Playbook, Natasha Karecki. Natasha, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
First off, this hour, former President Barack Obama has been talking at the University of Chicago. There's a group of students he's been meeting with as well. What's the sense of what the point of this past hour has been?
Well, it's sort of, he had his 3 months off. He did his little skydiving thing. And
with Richard Branson and all of the other things. Right.
Right. Exactly. Just kind of following along with some of what he said so far, he comes on stage and says, so what did I miss? You know, it's kind of like that Hamilton moment of Thomas Jefferson after the Revolutionary War. Like, did I miss anything? To some laughter. But some of it is, coming back to his roots, of course, Chicago. He was born in Hawaii, but then, he's a transplant here and built his career here and did his final address here, as you mentioned earlier. And this is just sort of getting back to, some of the people say this is what he wants to do, and that is to kind of help shape the next generation of leaders. And that's what he's doing today. He's talking with some different students at the University of Chicago in a roundtable, and there are different students in the audience who were from various universities who received tickets to attend. So that's sort of, maybe the beginning of
maybe a little glimpse of what his post-presidential public life is going to look like a little bit.
Yeah, right. We're getting a little taste of it now, which is interesting. And so it's a nice soft way for him to kind of re-enter, if you wanted a little break and then kind of re-enter the broader political discussion of what's happening now. It's a very safe area for him, University of Chicago. Of course, he once taught there as a constitutional law professor. So it's a homecoming of many sorts for him.
Speaking of national politics, we had U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren in Illinois in Chicago, met with Mayor Emanuel. What was that about, Natasha?
Right. So Elizabeth Warren just wrote a book, and so she's been going on different tours, having different visits across the country, and she was at the Music Box Theater on Saturday. But before that, she and Rahm Emanuel were at Cafe Sal Marie in Lincoln Square, they had a little meeting there. And apparently this isn't that unusual for the two of them. They do meet fairly regularly. When he's in D.C., when he was in Washington last month, they met. And apparently they just, they talk about national politics. They talk about strategy to whatever extent there is. And, just the future of the Democratic Party. Of course, Rahm, in his earlier life, was very involved in national Democratic politics. And before he went to the White House and in kind of in between his stints at the White House, between Clinton and Obama. So he's, he has just a real natural interest in that. And, that's sort of what they were talking about.
And it's interesting. It's interesting. Obviously, she's already being talked about as a 2020 presidential prospect. I feel like everyone, whenever they mention Senator Warren, brings up presidential prospects. It seems to me, given how Illinois has voted in the past, she'd probably be a pretty popular candidate in Illinois.
I would think so too. And if you look at the Bernie Sanders, the energy he brought here. I mean, of course, Clinton did win in the primary, but it was close. He had a lot of supporters, and a lot of the energy in that part of the party was kind of more to the left. And Elizabeth Warren's largely seen as being more aligned with the Bernie Sanders type of like ultra progressive, very outspoken. She's challenged, she's challenged all of the hierarchy of the Republican Party. And she was also just named by Time Magazine one of the 100 most influential people in the world.
Wow.
So, yeah, Rahm Emanuel having been seen with her, you know, is not a bad thing for him either.
Right. Let's move on to state politics. Tomorrow, Natasha, the House is voting on a bill related to abortion that's become quite controversial. It's HB 40. It actually happens to coincide with a women's march in Springfield. Let's start with the bill first and just talk about what's in HB 40.
So there's two main tenets of HB 40, and one is to overturn this so-called trigger law that was put in the books in the 70s in Illinois, which basically says if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade and gives some of the power back to the states on that, you know, that first trimester of abortion, that Illinois would automatically criminalize abortion in all cases. So this would overturn that to add a protection if, you know, in the Trump America, you know, Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, the trigger law in Illinois would no longer be if HB 40 is passed.
Right. So then it would it would keep abortion legal in Illinois if Roe versus Wade was overturned by the Supreme Court.
Yes, that's a much more simple way.
Right. Yeah. No. Just wanted to clear. No.
Exactly.
But there's been there's been a lot of controversy about Governor Rauner and statements he's made and support. And then there's also some other questions about state employees. And can you explain some of that?
Sure. So the other part of it is that the bill would also expand the funding, public funding of abortion. It would allow those on Medicaid to be covered for abortions. They are not now in Illinois. And state employees are not offered that under their health plans. And that is something that this bill would address. So that is really the part that conservatives do not like at all, an expansion of public funding for city employees and Cook County employees already have this benefit. State employees do not. So that is a very controversial part of the bill. It turns out that Bruce Rauner, who campaigned very heavily that he was pro-choice, that he didn't have a social agenda, he then said he was going to veto this bill. He was under pressure by the conservatives in the party who said, look, you want us to not primary you, you want us to support you again, you better veto this bill. And he acquiesced and said that he would. At the same time, he donated $50,000 to Planned Parenthood. He's trying to cover all his bases, but it's not happening. Everyone's upset over this. The conservatives are unhappy with his Planned Parenthood donation. Those on the left are livid with him, saying you know you lied to us. Hey, you said that you were going to be our governor. You're no social agenda, and here you're caving to conservatives. And we need this right now more than ever in Trump America. So it's a huge, huge clash. And if you notice, Mike Madigan's been awfully quiet on this whole topic. He's just sitting back and watching this right now.
That would, of course, be Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan.
Yeah.
And all of this is happening. It is interesting, Natasha, as you're talking about this, I do feel like this is the first clash in the Rauner administration about a social issue. Do you think that would be accurate? Because I think Governor Rauner has been very careful about making comments on anything, whether it's sort of about same-sex marriage or abortion or any of these things. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I certainly nothing that's risen to this level. And he's, you know, Rauner is sort of always kind of, you know, he's duplicitous in that sense. He tries to kind of say one thing and does the other and doesn't really ever commit. This was a time when he committed, both early on saying, I am, you know, personal PAC, a pro abortion rights group, revealed that he filled out this questionnaire and specifically said, I would support expansion of Medicaid for state employees and so forth. And that is exactly what he's saying he's going to veto now. So he's very much, you know, drawing a line in the sand and saying, I have to veto this for conservatives. So it's, this is really the first time that he's come down this hard on an issue, on a social issue like this.
And tomorrow there's a women's march in Springfield?
There is a women's march in Springfield. I'm still not clear on how many people, but they are talking about, you know, 5,000 women at minimum marching on Springfield, much like what we saw earlier this year in Chicago. You know, just abortion is going to be one of the big issues, reproductive rights in general, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment, all these things. And that is why there's all this talk about that is the day. There's going to be so much momentum and energy that they call this HB 40 and try to get that passed.
Well, and it's a really interesting question, Natasha, because we've all journalists had lots of conversation about the National Women's March and sort of how that trickles down into local action, whether that's in cities or at the state level. So it seems like tomorrow may be an interesting kind of question to see if all of those networks that were set up, if those women come out again.
That's exactly right. I think it'll be a really interesting barometer for, you know, what people are feeling right now in, you know, in Central America. You know, like where are they? Are they really still moved to take action as they were, you know, in kind of the months following that we saw these town halls that were passed? You know, are we really going to see them in numbers? And, from everything I'm hearing, it's going to be a very large turnout. There's all kinds of different speakers and so forth. It remains to be seen what kind of, you know, show of force there will be in Springfield.
So two other quick questions I wanted to ask you about. Democrats in the State House are hoping to raise the minimum wage. I feel like we've talked about this. This has kind of gone off the table, gone back on the table. Where do you see this going?
Well, so this is the interesting part of the pushback in particularly in the House, where the more progressive part of the party was pushing back on Mike Madigan, the Speaker, saying, "Look, what is your agenda? What is our agenda? This is what we want." So he is kind of giving them the reins and giving them more leeway to push forward some of their agenda, and this is part of it. It's the, you know, the $15 minimum wage. You know, it could pass the House. It might be difficult. I'm not sure, but they're at least he's letting them vote on it, take a vote. And to many of the progressives who you talk to, it's very important to them that they are able to have their voices heard and not feel like, you know, it's a top-down kind of governing, that they are able to do this. So $15 minimum wage, you know, I don't see the governor signing that.
Yeah, I don't see a Republican governor, especially Bruce Rauner, signing that. Let me ask you one more question about a transgender birth certificate bill that's sort of, again, as you're talking about these different issues that progressives are really pushing back on. That's also something that's now on the table?
Yes, and that, again, is, one of these more of the social kind of progressive bills that are. It's the Greg Harris bill, and it's something that's going to be, it's supposed to make it a little more easier for those who are transgender, who identify it with a different sex later on in life to amend their birth certificates. And that actually seems to have a little less controversy surrounded with it, far less than HB 40, and maybe even less than
than minimum wage.
Than the $15 minimum wage.
Right.
That is something that they're talking about might come up this week.
One last quick question for you. Last week, Governor Rauner told a group of suburban businessmen that they were, quote, very close to a budget deal. Are you hearing anything that would support that?
No one really knows what he's talking about because, you know, as we all know, there was a point where they were close to at least voting on the grand bargain, and he pulled a bunch of the votes off. Yes, if you ask individual state senators, of course they always want to keep compromising, but as far as a full-on deal coming together, no, there's not. And in fact, what they'll be voting on or taking up is this so-called lifeline stopgap bill that the House passed. And I do think that, you know, Senate President John Cullerton will have some difficulty with that because he did want to cut a deal. So it isn't to say that it isn't possible. It's always possible in Springfield, but I don't know where he's coming from with those statements.
That's Natasha Kurecki. She's with Politico. She's a senior reporter. She puts out the Illinois playbook every morning where you can see things like pictures of Governor Rauner. Was that with Alice Cooper this weekend? Was that the picture that you had?
That was Alice
this
Cooper.
Yes.
Yes, it is. Well,
okay.
Welcome to my
we
nightmare.
Tweet that out so you can follow Natasha. You can sign up for the playbook, get all the things we've been discussing and more. Natasha, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That does it for us today. That's all the time we have. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa and the NPR One app, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of the information on how to do that or contact us is at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.